For the moment, the trend is your friend. But what might upset that trend? This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management, or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing. Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, as usual, we got quite a bit to cover today, including our second half of our interview with Eric Basmajan of EPB Research, which he can be found at epbresearch.com. I didn't mention that website as much as I wanted last week. So epbresearch.com for our interview today. And again, if you want to hear the first half, you can go back. If you're listening over the podcast, you can go to the previous broadcast. If you go to our website under Smart Money Radio, you can find last week's show and catch the first half of his very excellent interview. And we're very happy to share the second half with you today. In addition, Jerry, we got some geopolitics to talk about, stocks to talk about. Where would you like to start?
It's going to be near impossible to cram all this into one show, but I'm going to do my best. It's, the issue, first of all, I want to tell you a little bit about, we're trying to get lined up. We're looking at scheduling, hopefully with Matt Gertkin, who's the, in my opinion, the best. He's the best geopolitical guy that I've seen, and he's got an article that came out January 9th, and I want to give you this information because it's something that, to me, I'm looking at it, okay, look, and we talked with Eric Basmajan last week with EPB Research, and he's like, okay, this is a mechanical process. The leading indicators of the economy are still going down. Now, they're not going down real fast right now, but they're still the engine on the train. All right, so manufacturing and construction are typically the leading indicators. There are other things. The stock market has proven it's changed over time, he points out in the interview. The stock market is really, in his opinion, not a leading indicator anymore. Ask him, okay, why? Why is that? It's because in the old days, 60s and 70s and even 80s, a higher percentage of the economy was manufacturing and so forth like that. And so they would get hit first, whereas a much higher percentage of the economy today is service.
Right, the manufacturing is way more cyclical. Where service is
right.
Less cyclical.
So you had companies back then that would have these big swings in the, much more volatile earnings because of the economy, much more volatile. They would downturn very quickly when there was the slightest amount of economic weakness, whereas now you got subscription-based things that people are subscribing to, Amazon, you name it. They've got, so it is a somewhat different, fairly different economy that doesn't outlaw the rule of gravity, though, the law of gravity. What I want to do on the second half...
It just changes what the stock market tells you about the economy.
And what's composed about
it.
So the leading indicators, in my view, have not stopped working. It's just that one component, I think, is not working as a leading indicator anymore, and it should be thrown out. If you look at the market today, it's real clear. The trend is your friend. Most everybody that I've read Ned Davis, Strategus, they said essentially the first 50 to 70 days of a president's administration is typically pretty volatile. The odds are high.
Especially with Trump. He is Mr. Volatile.
He's the ultimate turn over the table and kick the cards on the floor. I mean, he's got nothing to lose at this point.
Oh,
it's just amazing. So right now, for the stock market, all systems are still go. The trend is your friend. The valuations, if you look at price-to-earnings ratio, price-to-sales, and I'm toying with the idea of coming out with a new newsletter. I'm hoping to start on it next week, a new special report. The valuations are still historically extremely high. Now, some of that you might, again, contribute to being a little bit more of a service economy than in the past, and I think that's valid. At the same time, as the old saying goes, trees don't grow to the sky. Sooner or later, you have a downturn. So we'll be working on that newsletter. It's not available. It's in the thinking stage. I'm getting the contemplating, putting the pieces together. If you look at, I'm just looking at this one chart from Ned Davis here, who's turning out to be, so far, probably our most accurate in the stock market. His household stock holdings are at a record high versus financial assets. Higher than in 2000 in the dot-coms? Yes. Margin debt is...
We were talking earlier, it doesn't feel emotionally that way, because I'm not hearing people that don't normally invest saying, hey, this is what I'm invested in. I'm not hearing that now like we did back in the stock mania.
Back then, it was tech mania. You know, the classic case of the taxi driver tells you what stock pick.
Yeah.
You know, Bernard Baruch in the 1920s getting stock tips from the Shoeshine Boys.
But the percentage is higher
this time. At which point he sold because he's like, this is stupid. Anyway, but I'll just give you the headline of this. We don't have time to go into the whole detail today, but we'll be working on it in the newsletter. He said, this is Ned Davis Sr., who founded the company. Improved sentiment. So in other words, the view of the emotions toward the market have improved. There's less complacency, but still valuation, positioning, bubble. He used the word bubble. I did not. You know how bubbles work. Bubbles are disastrous when they blow up. But
they can last a long time.
And that's why valuations can tell you what risk is important,
right.
But they cannot tell you what timing. So with stock holdings at record high versus financial assets, you got to be keeping one eye on the risk. And we're going to talk a little bit later about the national debt, but that's after the interview with Eric.
He has a really interesting take on that.
He really does. I had David McCord, our market analyst and president of the company, go back and look at the valuations by year. Now, this is the Robert Shiller's case study. So Shiller's way of looking at earnings are just slightly different than traditional P.E. ratios and so forth. He has an index called the CAPE index, cyclically adjusted price earnings. That means we average the earnings over a decade, so there's not as much noise and up and down. But he had 1994. Why am I pulling up 1994? 1994 was the last time we had a soft landing, and it was a true soft landing. The Fed, and as a matter of fact, if you look at what the Fed did then and what the Fed's done now, and you overlay them, they're almost mirror images. They had three down ticks, then they flatlined for a while. I'm talking about when the Fed started lowering rates.
Right, because this time we raised way faster.
Yeah.
We're talking about after the raise.
After the fact, they raised very quickly then too, but not as fast. But the bottom line is we started a bull market, and you remember it, the dot-com era, mm-hmm. the technology bubble, and so forth, and a lot of names that disappeared and some that became enduring franchises of America. What was the price-earnings ratio then? In January of 94, it was 21. Again, this is the kind of dumbed down. He thinks it's more accurate. I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying this one methodology to look at it. It was at 21. Was it? As of February of this year, it's 30. So anyway, the price-to-earnings ratio on Shiller's take is 50% higher than it was in 1994. So if you look at the ingredients of a soft landing, something just doesn't feel right to me and hasn't all along. And again, if you look at the percentage of stocks, that again, this is not a crazy wild market like it was in 2000. But again, Ned Davis points out household stock holdings at a record high versus financial assets. It's never been that high, even in the dot-com era. So to say that this is just a bull market and it's going to march on or we have another 5 years, I have a concern about. Now, let me differentiate again between secular bulls and cyclical bulls. To me, I can make the case, and I think this is correct, that the, quote, secular bull, the multi-decade bull that we're in right now, probably will last. I mean, theoretically, if you base it on the demographic curve, and we'll have to make another show on this at some point, it's pointing at likely top based on age waves, based on how many people are born every year, to 2032.
That's based on the spending.
Based on spending stuff. If you read our book From Boom to Bust and Beyond, you'll understand that more effectively. But so essentially this is saying, hey, 2032 is the likely mega top. And my guess would be that after that, we have another 2008 type of event after that. So the good news is I don't see this being the end of the secular bull market. I think we're going to have a cyclical bear in the middle, though. At some point, and this is when you talk about not being able to predict things, this is one. I'm going to read you a brief quote from Matt Gertkin, who is my favorite geopolitical analyst with Bank Credit Analyst. And this kind of shocked me, Michael. And the reason it shocked me was he's not a sensationalist.
Oh, he's not.
He doesn't exaggerate. He doesn't hype to stir right. business, to make sales. He's an extremely good analyst. And by the way, he's got, I think, five other economists on his staff here. One, two, three, four, five. Yep, so six economists working on this together. And he said, here's what he thinks is likely to happen. He does not think the U.S. will be able to negotiate a deal with Iran successfully. And let me explain why. That's not bashing Trump. That's looking at what's going on in the Middle East. He said, we give this year in 2025. He's talking about 2025. He's not talking about the future long term. He's saying this year in 2025. He said, this year we give a 75% chance of military escalation with Iran and only slightly lower than that on having another oil shock. Now, if we have an oil shock, this to me, I've been scratching my head for months going, okay, if we do have a downturn, because again, if you look at history, which is not a perfect guide, but it rhymes, as Mark Twain said, if you look at history, you don't start another massive bull market when stock valuations are extremely high, when margin levels are extremely high, and we're getting record numbers on all that. That's not normally where you start another bull market.
All right, you got to have some sort of correction to bring it down.
You typically have a cleansing first. It comes down, and then you start another one. All right, so, and again, I think it won't be a massive 2008 kind of deal this time around, but something likely upset the apple cart. So Matt makes the case. He said, we give this a 75% chance of military escalation with Iran and only slightly lower odds of a significant oil price shock. Now, I've never, and this is what got my attention, and I was reading the article, and I had to go, I missed this at first. I'm like, because I've never seen him go that high on anything he's predicted on geopolitics. I went, I did a double take. I'm like, wait a minute. Did he say what I think he said? He said, yeah, a 75% chance of military escalation. He said, Israel has a once-in-a-generation opportunity to deal a major blow to the Iranian regime, or at least set back its nuclear program, emphasizing the word once in a generation. He said, now, obviously, the Iranians are trying to dodge this, dodge Israeli pressure, withdrawing from Syria, appealing to Trump, and so forth. But they're also ramping up their nuclear program as leverage, quote unquote. And if you look at a chart on his newsletter, which we're trying to get him on the show, we'll get it out to everybody. There's been a massive upgrade in centrifuges for nuclear. I mean, massive, since 2020. So the production of highly enriched uranium slowed slightly, but the capacity to produce it has surged by a factor of 4 or 6 times. 400 to 600 times higher to be able to produce highly enriched uranium. Tehran also says that if Israel strikes again, this will mean a large-scale, quote-unquote, regional war. Trump intends to resume the enforcement of oil sanctions on them. Europe will probably also do the same, but Trump will be willing to talk in case he can get a magnificent deal. So Trump's goal would get a magnificent deal and fix the Middle East, one that freezes the nuclear program and enables sanction relief and regional trade to flourish. Marginally lower oil prices and inflation out of that. The problem is that Israel will not accept a short-term Iranian deal that does not foreclose nuclear weaponization over the long run. They said even if Benjamin Netanyahu suddenly falls from power, the next Israeli prime minister probably cannot afford to pass up on the chance to set back the nuclear program.
And Matt even said when I saw him in person, it doesn't even matter if that person's on the complete opposite side of the political spectrum.
It's unanimous across the government in Israel. Meanwhile, if Israel takes unilateral, military action, the U.S. is very likely to pile on to Iran to ensure the job gets done as quickly and effectively as possible. So Trump's going to try to negotiate a deal. He doesn't want to have a war. At the same time, the Israelis are going, We have a once-in-a-generation opportunity here. We got Hamas out of the way. We got Hezbollah pretty well out of the way. The Houthis are behaving. This is our chance. And the people that live in Iran are ready for regime change. They hate the current regime. And there was a good article. This is probably close to 10 years ago, written by The Economist magazine about how Iran is becoming the most secular state in the Middle East, not believing in Allah. Now you're seeing a huge Christian revival going on over there, and there are people, and this is, I've seen, this is not just one report. I've seen dozens of reports about this, that people, and you can take this however you want to as your own religious convictions, but dozens of times I've seen articles about people are having dreams about Jesus, and whole tribes of people are getting saved and going, becoming Christians. So the issue here is this is a massive deal that's going on. They said a full-scale war would exceed even regional spare capacity in terms of oil. It would likely push the price of oil to extreme highs, which in my view, it reminds me of when they took Saddam Hussein out. You know, he burned 1,000 oil wells. That wasn't World War III, number one. Number two, it did cause a bear market and recession in America, but it was fairly short-lived recession and a fairly short-lived bear. The bear, you know, it all started in end of July of 1989. I remember it vividly. What happened was that U.S. satellites had picked up with their intelligence the fact that Saddam was amassing troops on the border of Kuwait. And so that kind of somehow or other, that information sneaked out, leaked into the commodity pits, and the futures markets for oil started going through the roof, gold started going through the roof, stocks started going down, and then a month later we all found out why, because he did invade. And so then the bear market started, then we had a recession. It was not a long-lasting recession, it was short. But the bear market was significant, 30% or so off the top of my head. That's what I remember for the S&P 500. But again, it's not, it wasn't a 2008 kind of event. So that's what I think the risks are today. I think that the primary risk, and again, I could be wrong, and I've been wrong before. And you could look at the newsletter I wrote in September and say, oh, that's wrong. And I'm like, well, it may not be. It may not be wrong. We'll see. And that's why I'm writing an update to it in this month, probably starting on it next week. But the point is real simple. The odds are, again, the old saying is trees don't grow to the sky. You typically will have downturns. But the issue is, it's important to know, is it a grizzly bear market or is it a black bear market? And Michael, we don't have time on today's show to elaborate on that. We probably should do that next week, though, because I don't see it being a 2008 kind of grizzly bear. And if you don't know the rules on bear engagement, if it's a black bear, you're in Yellowstone Park, you're camping, a black bear knocks over your trash can, make a lot of noise, bang on pots, try to scare the dude away. He usually, they scare away. If it's a grizzly bear, roll up in a ball, put your hands over your head, and lay still like you're dead.
Do a lot of praying.
Yeah, and do a lot of praying, because a grizzly can be up to, you know, 2,500 pounds, and if you try to fight him, he thinks this is awesome fun,
right?
And he will kill you. So bottom line is, there are grizzly bears, there are black bears, there should be different strategies for both. I don't see a grizzly bear happening in this cycle. I think we might have, I think the odds are high we're going to have a black bear. That would then pull the valuations down. That would then pull the margin debt down. That would pull the percentage of financial assets and stocks, which is the highest on record, down. And it kind of like reboots the engine. Like, okay, then I think we're probably going to have another takeoff. Best guess out to 2032-ish. So we'll elaborate on these things. I'm working on it for the special report. What I want to do at this point.
I was talking to David last week about that, just corrections in general, that even small corrections could be a healthy thing for the market.
Yes.
Like you're saying, it brings the valuations down.
They are.
And as David puts it, it gives us a better feel for the actual market.
It really does.
Some of the people that were just over-leveraged, doing crazy stuff.
Good point.
Now had to back out, and we can get a feel for what is the foundation of the market.
When you have a historic bubble like we had in 2000, the ramifications lasted for over a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So the issue is, it is healthier. It's kind of like we had a pretty good freeze here in January. Well, it killed the bugs. If you don't ever have a freeze, you don't kill the bugs. In other words, there's renovation that happens through difficulties like this, and in the stock market is no different. If you have a good, healthy mama bear, not a daddy bear market, so I think we're looking at a 250-pound black bear kind of deal, not a 12 or 15 or 2,500-pound grizzly, then I think that's more likely what I think I'm seeing.
All right, we'd like to take just a brief moment to remind you about Cornerstone with Jerry Tuma, myself, David McCord, and the rest of our team. You can learn about us by going to cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. You can get Jerry's special reports. And again, when he sends out a new one, it goes out via the email list first for the first few weeks. So if you want to be in that early group, you do need to go online and sign up for Jerry's special reports. Again, we don't do any selling of your information. We don't want to. We're not allowed to. We just keep it in-house, and then we just send out about a weekly email just saying, hey, the new current show is available on podcast and on our email if you missed it on the radio. And then when the special reports come out, we'll include it in that email. Again, you can listen to previous broadcasts and interviews on our website. You can also find those on podcast format on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Audible. If you'd like to reach out for a free consultation, please give us a call at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285, and I would love the chance to interact with you. All right, Jerry, we're about to go to our second half of our interview with Eric Masmajian. Just kind of remind people that Eric is the economic cycle analyst and founder of EPB Research, which can be found at epbresearch.com. They use a unique process that simplifies the business cycle analysis through a proven sequential framework, helping investors and business owners understand and leverage economic trends into better investment decisions. So again, their focus on the business cycle, how to understand the business cycle to help businesses and individuals with their investment decisions. So again, last week we talked to Eric about a few topics. Anything you want to just kind of briefly review?
I just want to say that it's probably the best single understanding and the best way to explain and get the business cycle. You know, he pointed out that some of the delays we've seen, I'm looking at something from Stratagus, the longest contraction on record on the leading economic indicators, which appears to be over, maybe, we'll see. In other words, it's right now we're seeing what I would call a dead cat bounce in the leading indicators, but that's, as Eric points out, we need 3 or 4 months of true growth. So historically what happens is if the leading economic indicators resume a downtrend, you know, we're still going to have a recession. If it doesn't and it starts to turn around, and he points out one little blip for one little month is not going to be a turnaround. You need 3 or 4 months of consistent uptrend in the things that are going in trouble, which are in trouble right now. Still, manufacturing is weak and housing is very weak. Mm-hmm. So those are the two that contract first. So the leading indicators, which include things like the money supply, all these factors, again, we don't have time to get into all of it right now. Bottom line is they have not confirmed an uptrend yet, even though the market is going up. But he said that the stock market really is no longer a good leading indicator of the economy. We talked about in the first half. But some things that kind of stick out from the first interview we did, part of why are we seeing such a long contraction in the leading indicators, he said a lot of it, and this makes sense in hindsight, I didn't see it last year, okay, part of it is the construction delays due to the pandemic. It used to take 7.5 months to build a house. That median is out to 10 months. It used to take 14 months to build an apartment. Now it's out to 30 months to build an apartment. So you had this extremely elongated cycle in the construction realm. We've also shifted the composite. I think you said something like 70% of the construction in housing was in single-family residents back in 2008, and now it's like 60% is in multifamily because the kids, the millennials, Again, this goes back to the age wave in our book From Boom to Bust and Beyond. Millennials can't afford to buy a house at these elevated prices, especially with the interest rates this high. So there were certain anomalies of this business cycle, which means to me you don't throw the cycle out. It still, I believe, will work. The question is, will it turn around? We have I always like the term a dead cat bounce, and if you're not familiar with that in investment lingo, if you push the dead cat out of a tall enough window, it's going to bounce a little bit. Right now, this is a dead cat bouncing the leading indicators. If we're going into a full-blown recovery and another massive bull without an interruption to that, then this thing will turn around and it will be a sustained uptrend. Otherwise, I'm still watching for that black swan that could cause another bear.
All right, and in this second half of the interview, we'll get Eric's view on, are we going to have a true soft landing? And his very interesting take on the compounding national debt. Let's go to the interview with Eric Basbajian of EPB Research.
The Wall Street view of the world is that we're in a soft landing today. And I would say that's still to be determined. If we do see a true soft landing, which Wall Street's convinced we're in right now and could end up being the case, the last one I lived through was 1994. I know there was another one in 1996 where the leading indicators appeared to be telling us we're in a recession and we had a soft landing instead. What do you think we're going to see from here? What's your personal opinion?
So I believe that as you mentioned earlier, the jury is still out on whether we've had a soft landing or not. And the reason for that is because the leading indicators are still trending down. And like we said, these leading indicators are not voodoo. They're not magic. They represent a basket of mechanical variables that have to lead. So we're things like new orders for manufactured goods, things like building permits, things like the availability of money and credit. So those factors are still contracting, which to me says that we can't say that the economy has landed, because those leading indicators are still going to transmit through that four economy framework that I referenced. We're still going to see downward pressure over the next several months in that cyclical or construction and manufacturing bucket, because the leading indicators or leading economy has not yet turned up. Should the leading indicators turn up, and they have to turn up in a way that is somewhat sustained or persistent. You know, 1 month is not a change in trend, or if it goes up a tenth of a percent, that's not a change in trend. But if you see 3-4 months and it's a magnitude that's consistent with past upturns, then what we would say is, okay, the leading indicators have turned up. There's going to be potentially a couple more months of weakness because of that lagged effect. But once we start to see that cyclical economy or those construction and manufacturing sectors level off, that's it. That's going to be the end of the downturn, because that leading part of the economy is already turning higher. So that leveling out that we may see would be it. But because we don't have that yet, we don't have a leveling off of those construction and manufacturing sectors yet, and we don't have a upturn in the leading indicators or leading economy, I still believe that the economy has risk of recession. I still believe that the economy is on a path that is going to be slowing. Since those construction and manufacturing sectors really are the engine of the economy, those are the big boom bust sectors. But if you're part of that services sector or that lagging economy, this is not a slowdown that's going to hit you in the next 3 months or 4 months, right? There's a lot of time to snake through the economy. We're still in that second bucket right now, where the slowdown is just starting to come through construction and manufacturing. So, I just want to have a little bit of nuance to that answer. But I don't see the economy having achieved a soft landing for sure. And I think that the probabilities of a soft landing are overstated at the moment. Recessionary concerns may have been overstated, 6 months ago or 8 months ago. We're back to the other side of the boat now, where the soft landing probabilities are probably overstated. And I think we'll swing back as job losses become more prevalent in those construction and manufacturing sectors.
It's excellent, because that helps clarify a lot of things to me that I've been puzzling over for a while. Last few months, I'm like, okay, this cycle just seems to be, like I said, starting out a little bit on the weird side, that everything you're saying makes total sense.
It does, and just to add one more point here, is that the sentiment of soft landing or hard landing and the sentiment of Wall Street, we have to remember, is just a derivative of the stock market. And by stock market, I mean S&P 500. And by that, I mean NASDAQ. And by that, I mean seven companies, right? So the performance of those seven companies that really drive the overall stock market has been extraordinary over the last 12 months. That really has nothing to do with what's happening in the earlier part of this business cycle sequence that we discussed. But it's, you know, built to avoid, and you know, why, we all understand why. But the performance of those stocks really drives everyone's opinion about what's happening in the economy. So when we had that, you know, regional bank issue in 2023, that's when everyone's recession fears were dialed up very significantly, because stock prices were declining. As those stock prices recovered, everyone's, you know, fears went away. And there was no change to this overall sequence that we talk about. The sequences continue to play out, but the gyrations of the stock market are really what drive everyone's opinion. I don't think that's a good way to assess the economy. And I just want to remind the audience that, you know, using a business cycle sequence to predict peaks and troughs in the stock market is a challenging exercise, particularly when the stock market is driven by companies that really fall in that lagging economic bucket. So you're going to see downturns in leading indicators, you're going to see inversions of yield curves, and the stock market's not really going to think much about it, because those companies don't derive their earnings from really volatile sources. But if you really wanted to squint inside the weeds, you really can't look at big stock indexes, because they are just dwarfed by just very few companies. But if you look inside the weeds and you look to companies that are oriented towards those construction and manufacturing sectors, or are not the beneficiaries of these passive flows, you will see changes that are more reflective of what's happening in the earlier part of the business cycle sequence. The example that I would give is that the Russell 3000 makes up the vast majority of the investable stocks. Let's say there's 3,000 in, you know, investable stocks, for argument's sake. The Russell 2000 is the smallest 2,000 of those 3,000 stocks. So, round numbers, 70% of the investable stock universe. That Russell 2000 is at the same level today as it was in 2021, which, Jerry, as you know, just happened to be the peak and beginning of decline in many of the leading indicators. So you have vast swaths of the stock market that have not made any gains at all in virtually 4 years. That is reflective of some of the stagnation that we've begun to see in construction and manufacturing, for example, while the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, driven by the service sector technology companies, has been extraordinary. So stocks are not a great barometer of the economy, but if you do want to use the stock market, you have to get a little bit more nuanced about what pockets of the stock market you're looking at and try and relate them to that four economies, or that sequence that we've been talking about.
Excellent. Excellent analysis, Eric. I want to shift gears one more time to a little bit more of a longer term picture. I've long been concerned about the compounding national debt, which I think is a much bigger problem that most people seem to be thinking about right now. And it's always, well, put it off because it's down in the future. We don't worry about that. We're worried about the next quarterly earnings. The entitlement payments to the baby boomers, et cetera, are starting to become huge, especially Medicare, and we got Social Security. Does your work have anything to say about the long-term entitlement problems with our national debt now at $36 trillion and counting?
So you're hitting on an extremely important issue, and one that I'm quite passionate about as well. We have to shift gears, because this is not a business cycle related.
Right.
This is what we would call a secular economic trend, or trends that take 10, 15, 20 years. And the reason these are such difficult problems to tackle is because the effects are imperceptible on a year-by-year basis. You can't feel the effect of the growing national debt from 2024 to 2025. No one can really feel that effect. But everyone can feel it when they think about 2025 compared to 2005 or 2010, for example. When you look back 10 years or when you look back 15 years or 20 years and you feel, you feel the trajectory that you feel the economy's on or the trajectory that you feel personally that you're on, stacked up over 10 or 15 or 20 years, you say, wow, this is really a lot different than I expected things would go. So those small year-by-year changes compound to be something meaningful in terms of a deleterious effect. So where I shake out on this is, and I try and be careful about the way that I say it because I don't want to wander into a political issue. I'm going to try and use economics only. And if I get too abstract, just cut me off here, Jerry. But
all right,
there was a really wonderful paper published by two economists that looked at the effect of government size on economic growth. And it was a really well-researched paper, and they looked at tons of different countries, tons of historical sample sizes. And what they found was that the effect of government size is an upside down U. So it's the shape of a U, but upside down. And what that means is zero government size, so no government, is really bad because that's pure anarchy, right? That's not very conducive to economic growth. There's no rules, there's no laws. As the government forms and the government becomes 2% of the economy and 5% of the economy and 7% of the economy, there's a positive effect on economic growth. As the government continues to grow and get larger and larger and larger, then they become basically a neutral, no effect on growth. And then as they get larger and larger, you start to go down the backside of that U where the government begins to be a drag on economic growth.
So it's regressive at that point.
Exactly. And by a drag on economic growth, we're not talking about a negative. We're talking about a rate of change. So we're talking about the government stifling growth from 2.5 to 2.25. And that's what we were talking about, where no one can feel the difference between 2.5 and 2.25. But if you stack that up over 10 years, then that delta becomes $10,000 in GDP per capita or $12,000 in GDP per capita. And that does matter. So the million-dollar question or trillion-dollar question is, what's the magical size? What's the perfect size of the government to which they are, you know, beneficial to the economy but not dragging? And that answer is really difficult, and I don't think anyone solved it with two decimals of precision. But I think it's clear at this point that the government has grown to a size which, the way that they measure government size, I probably should have mentioned, is expenditures as a percentage of GDP, not the deficit as a percentage of GDP, the raw expenditures. So the government, state, local, and federal, spends about $10 trillion. The economy is, 30-something trillion dollars. So the government size is about 33-34%, meaning that the government is spending, $10 trillion out of 30, right? Now, they tax some of it, and there's a deficit and so on and so forth. But I don't want anyone to focus on the deficit for now. I want everyone to focus on the raw level of expenditures, because if they spent $15 trillion, they could run a surplus. They just would have to tax the whole thing, right? And if they, if they go the other way, they could run a deficit if they have no taxes. So it's really the raw level of expenditures. And the government has grown to spending, $10.5 trillion. Most of that is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, interest, and some defense. And that's become about 33 or 34% of the economy. To give everyone a comparison, in the 1960s, that was about 22%. So the government size has grown from about 22% in the 1960s to 34, 35% now. And given the path that we're on for these entitlement programs, should we not change them, the government size is absolutely going to continue to grow to be 35, 40, 45. And at some point, if we just continue on this path, the government will be greater than 50% of the economy. And of course, we're now wandering into the area where it's regressive or a negative on growth. So that's my view on the debt situation and the entitlement situation, is that we really do have to get this under control, because the government has become so large in distributing resources across the economy and spending, and it is having a drag on growth. But like I said, it's a very difficult problem, because in any given year, it's a 0.1% or 0.25%, which is not enough to motivate anyone to fix it in any given year. But the populace continues to stack that up over 10 years and continues to feel these negative consequences in a reduced standard of living, which is making, people very upset. So the administration currently has, offered some plans about how they may be able to try and reduce that. We'll see if they're able to. It's a difficult problem, because the entitlements are really the driving force behind that. And no one really wants to touch those. So we'll see how that goes.
Excellent analysis here. The number you gave out, was that the federal government only, or was that at federal, state, local?
Federal,
all
state.
Of the above. Okay, that's what I thought you said. So.
Yeah. And just to add a little more kindling to the fire, the composition of government spending that is federal has grown massively. So in the 1960s, that 22% number that I gave you, a certain percentage of that was federal and a certain percentage of that was state and local. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. Today, the 33 or 34%, some of it's federal, some of it's state and local. Over the decades, the amount of government spending that's federal has increased massively, massively. So not only is the government growing larger, the concentration is shifting from state and local to federal.
Mm.
So government's growing larger and it's becoming more centralized at the federal. Both of those things seem to have negative consequences. I think there's a, as a fan of Milton Friedman, there's a one of his best books, Free to Choose. It's a very
right.
easy to understand book. I recommend everyone read it. It's really a great book. I think the numbers were something like maybe in the late 1800s, the government size was about 12% of the economy, and 2/3 of that was state and local. So 8% was state and local, 4% was federal. The total was 12. And here we are today at 34-35%. And I think the numbers are more than 2/3 of ours federal. So,
well, and we'll be pushing European levels of government spending here in the near term if this doesn't change
the
trajectory.
That's exactly. I think France is above 50. And
right.
So you're exactly right.
And so that's been all. It's almost my life calling, if you want to call it that, is, okay, this is a big problem. We're only seeing the top of the iceberg right now. I think it's going to be a big, huge issue. And as there's a book by a guy named Ken Dykewald years ago called Age Wave, where he pointed out that Medicare spending, 2/3 of all Medicare spending occurs in the last 9 months of a fatal illness. As you see the 76 million baby boomers, how many of us are left, moving into Medicare, which mostly are not right now. Mostly the boomers are still younger. They're on Social Security, typically about half on Social Security, maybe a little more than half. But that Medicare thing is the big gorilla in the long run. So I see this becoming a big explosive problem with the demographics down the road.
It's a really explosive problem, and it is one that is really complicated to solve.
To try to fix is, how are you going to, okay, we need to kill 10 million people to get rid.
That really.
I think one of the liberals actually, talked about that. I'm hiding my eyes as I'm saying this.
It's a really complicated problem to solve, especially the Medicare one. The Social Security one is not that complicated to solve through some shared sacrifice and some changes, although that may be difficult, but it's much less difficult than healthcare.
It is. It
much
is.
Less than.
Well, Eric, this has been an excellent interview. We sure appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for inviting me.
All right, Jerry. Well, that was an excellent interview with Eric Basmajan of epbresearch.com. Again, you can subscribe to him. You can go there, and he has a lot of good information on YouTube that's just out there for free. You can watch. He does his own interviews with other economists out there, and some people he even disagrees with. It's very interesting to watch, but highly recommend eppresearch.com.
And, you know, one of the things that stands out to me, we talked a little bit about the lagging indicators, leading indicators on last week's show. So if you didn't hear that, go back to our website and listen to the first half of this show.
Or your favorite podcast location.
Or your favorite podcast, yeah. Michael will give you the data on how to get the podcast. But a couple of things that just jump out at me on this part of the interview. The first part of the interview was outstanding. He explained why the leading indicators appear to be slow, but I still think they're going to be accurate. In other words, one or two things are going to happen. Either the leading indicators are going to stop falling, and right now, again, we had what I'm calling a dead cat bounce. We had a slight little bing, little bitty bounce, and is the trend going to keep going down, or is the trend going to accelerate back up? As he pointed out, we need at least 3 or 4 months of the leading indicators going up, and not just a little bit, establishing a new uptrend.
We need a new trend.
A new up wave, if you want to say that. And if we don't have it, then there's something rotten here in Denmark, so to speak. And the stock market, as he mentioned, and I think this is excellent analysis, is proving to be it's not really a leading indicator anymore because of how the economy shifted. So let's talk about the things that are jumping out at me about this interview. The biggest part of the second half of it, though, was about the national debt. He pointed out that we're at 34-35% of the... basically, the economy is now being consumed by government of all forms. Now, some of that is productive because people that work for the government, you know, if you're in the military, you get a paycheck, you rent a house, you know, it's so some you can't throw it all out, the baby with the bathwater. But what he's saying is, he called it an upside down U. There's a point in time, so you start out with almost no government, chaos, you reach a point which is no. You know, in theory, we don't know exactly, no one knows exactly where that number is, but you reach a point in time when you're kind of optimal in terms of what percentage of spending for the government is the best.
For the economy.
For the economy.
How it stimulates the economy.
Exactly. And then if you get too far, like the Europeans, if you look at the Europeans, their whole economy is sclerotic. As we pointed out, France has over 50%, this is mind-boggling to me, 50% of their economy is run through their federal government, which is just insanity. And if you look at the stock markets, go back and look at the IFA. Go back and look at France's stock market since 2008. Go back and look at Germany's stock market since 2008. They're terrible in comparison to the United States. The United States has been the only place to go since 2008. Even the emerging markets, like India, is probably the one exception, but most emerging markets have not performed well since then. All right, so here's the biggest, I'm going to give the punchline, though. I'm reading from an analysis from Pete Peterson, and Pete Peterson Institute Foundation is one of the best sources you can get for data on the national debt and its long-term effect. Because, again, it's a compounding issue, and as Eric mentioned, you know, you won't notice the difference if we go from 2.5% growth to 2.25% in a calendar year. But if you go back 10, 15, 20 years and you see that compounding effect of that reduction in the economy's capacity, then you see the living standards go way down. Problem, though, the 800-pound gorilla, as we pointed out before, Medicare in particular, but Social Security, Ken Dykewell pointed out that 2/3 of Medicare spending occurs historically in the last 9 months of a fatal illness. The baby boomers, 76 million people, if you haven't read a book, go read it. From boom to bust and beyond, the baby boomers are not that old yet, for the most case. For most of the time, the baby boomers, about a little over half of us, are probably in I'll be 70 in September. I decided to go ahead and take Social Security now. but I'm still relatively healthy. I don't expect to die in the next 10 years. But what's going to happen is as the age wave moves like the pig and the python, and more people are compounding into the Medicare part of it, which happens in the next decade, not this decade, the next decade, then I think you're going to have big, big issues. So the point is the deficits are out of control. I do believe that what they're doing in terms of trying to cut government waste spending and idiotic, you know, spending sprees by the far left, essentially that is vital, but that cannot reduce the number of people that are in Medicare, Social Security, the military. You can't do away with entirely. So the biggest part of the budget of the federal government is non-touchable. That's why they call Social Security the third rail of American politics, which in the old days, you know, when they had the, you know, the street, not streetcars, but the trains in Chicago, if you fell into the middle track, it electrocuted you. And politically, those have been untouchable, and they still are, and Trump even hasn't talked about cutting them. So we're going to have, and that's another reason we'll just keep developing this theme. It looks to me like we will likely have, I still think we're going to have a bear market, but I don't think it's going to be a really big one, probably a mama bear, not the daddy bear. But when you get into the 2030s, the whole world's going to change, and I'm concerned about the geopolitical world. I'm concerned about geopolitics this year with Iran and Israel. But anyway, that's all the time we have for today's show. If you haven't gotten the entire interview from Eric, get on our website and get it. CornerstoneReport.com is our website. And if you want to call for a consultation, 800-327-4285.
You can also find us at most of your favorite podcast locations like Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Audible. Just search for Jerry Tumas Smart Money.
Jerry Tumas Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tumas is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services, an independent financial group, LLC, or unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tumas Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.